Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're opening up a political text that was, well, so explosive its author nearly got executed for writing it. We're diving into Thomas Paine's foundational work, Rights of Man.
Yeah, it's really hard to overstate the impact of this one. It wasn't just abstract theory. It was almost like a manual for revolution that jumped across continents.
Right.
Our mission today, I think, is to unpack why this, you know, 18th century text is still maybe the clearest blueprint we have for modern democracy, for popular sovereignty, and maybe surprisingly, the philosophical roots of the welfare state.
It's true. When you read Paine, you realize he wasn't just talking about, like, tweaking the system.
Yeah.
He was fundamentally questioning the entire justification for how states rule. He basically said the past has zero legitimate authority over us now.
Exactly. That's the absolute core. Government legitimacy, he argues, doesn't come from tradition or, you know, some ancient family line or divine right. Mm-hmm. It comes only from the conscious, explicit consent of the people it governs, right here, right now. The living.
Okay, so before we really get into the book itself, we have to talk about Paine the man. Because he's fascinating, right? He wasn't some powdered wig academic in an ivory tower.
Not at all. Thomas Paine, born 1737, died 1809. English-born, but really became this key American revolutionary figure. And, you know, not formally educated in the big university.
Right, he was like a corset maker.
Yeah.
A tax collector.
Yeah, and a journalist. His real power, his authority, it didn't come from fancy titles. It came from his incredible ability to take really complex political ideas and just distill them in a clear, punchy, accessible language. He wrote for ordinary people, not philosophers.
And his authority was kind of earned in the trenches, wasn't it? He actually lived through the revolutions he wrote about.
He really did. He was an active participant, an eyewitness to both the American Revolution. I mean, his pamphlet, Common Sense, was hugely influential there.
Arguably tipped the scales for independence.
You could definitely argue that. And then he was right there in the thick of the French Revolution, too. So this transatlantic view gave him this unique vantage point. He could compare the, well, the messy but rational birth of the American Republic with these decaying, sclerotic monarchies back in Europe. His belief in liberty wasn't just theory. It was based on what he saw.
Okay, so let's unpack the book itself, Rights of Man. It wasn't written in a vacuum, was it? It was a direct shot at a very famous conservative thinker.
Correct. You have to see it as intellectual combat. Paine wrote Rights of Man specifically as this fiery defense of the French Revolution. It was a direct point-by-point rebuttal to Edmund Burke's really influential critique, Reflections on the Revolution in France.
And Burke was all about tradition, history, hereditary rights.
Exactly. Burke defended the status quo based on historical continuity. Paine basically set out to demolish those arguments and replace them with reason and universal human rights.
So the book kind of has this two-part structure, right? First, tear down the old arguments and build up the new vision. Deconstruction, then reconstruction.
Precisely. Part one is all about dismantling Burke's arguments, especially the appeal to history and precedent. Paine attacks this whole idea of governing beyond the grave, you know, the notion that past generations can bind the future.
We'll definitely come back to that phrase.
And then part two shifts completely. It becomes this detailed, pretty visionary blueprint for a new kind of world order based on, well, representative government, a written constitution, and these quite radical social policies.
And that's where it gets really surprising for many people, right? It goes way beyond just political theory. It's not just about who gets to vote. It gets into economics, into survival. Yeah. Paine lays out this incredibly detailed plan for progressive taxation to fund a whole social welfare system. Education for the poor, pensions for the elderly, even help for new mothers. He ties political freedom directly to economic security.
For Paine, you couldn't really separate them. What good is the right to vote if you're starving? That's not real freedom, in his view.
Okay, let's dive deeper into that first part, the deconstruction. His attack on tradition, using that phrase, the tyranny of the dead.
It's such a powerful line. It's like the ultimate rejection of just deferring to history. His core argument is simple. Every generation is born equal with the same rights. Therefore, every generation must be free to choose its own government.
So no 17th century parliament or king gets to dictate how 18th century people live.
Exactly. When these old institutions or dead monarchs claim the right to bind the present, Paine calls it the vanity and presumption of governing beyond the grave. It's basically an insult to the living, to their sovereignty.
So powerful. And he clarifies this by distinguishing between different kinds of rights, doesn't he?
Yes, he makes a really useful distinction. He talks about natural rights. These are the rights you have just by being human. Think freedom of thought, freedom of conscience, the right to pursue your own happiness. You don't get these from government. They're inherent.
Okay.
Then there are civil rights. These are basically extensions of natural rights, but they're ones that require society acting together to secure things like protecting your property or ensuring you get a fair trial.
So if civil rights need society to secure them, what does that imply about the role of government?
Well, for Paine, it means government has one single legitimate purpose. It's essentially a shared pool of our collective power organized specifically to protect those civil rights that we as individuals can't effectively protect on our own.
And the French Revolution, in his view.
He saw it as a completely rational, even necessary act.
Mm-hmm.
An oppressed people taking back their sovereign power because the existing government had totally failed to protect their rights. It wasn't chaos, it was reclaiming rightful authority.
Okay, so if part one tears down monarchy and tradition, part two is where he starts laying out the plans for a republic. And he begins with this interesting distinction between society and government.
Yeah, it's another one of his famous lines. Society is produced by our wants and government by our wickedness.
Huh. Explain that.
Well, he sees society as natural, positive. It arises organically because we want to cooperate, trade, help each other. It promotes happiness positively. Government, on the other hand, is artificial. It's a necessary evil. Necessary only because of human flaws, our wickedness. Its role is negative, just to restrain vice.
So the better people are, the less government they need.
That's the implication. A highly ethical, functional society would require very little government interference, in his view.
But hang on, that sounds almost libertarian. How does that square with the huge welfare state he then proposes in the same book? If government is just this negative thing stopping bad behavior, how can it also run massive social programs?
Ah, that's the really interesting tension, maybe even a seeming contradiction in Paine. But I think he resolves it. He's saying the current forms of government, monarchies, aristocracies, those are the source of vice and corruption.
Okay.
A rational, limited republican government, one designed by the people, is different. It becomes an instrument created by society for the general welfare. And the key to keeping it limited and serving its purpose is a written constitution.
Right. He insists on that.
Absolutely. He argues a constitution isn't just an idea. It has to exist before the government is even formed. It defines the government's powers, its limits, its structure, its duties. It's the instruction manual created by the sovereign people.
And he famously uses this point to critique the British system, right?
Yeah.
Saying they don't really have a constitution you can point to.
Exactly. The British like to talk about their unwritten constitution based on centuries of tradition and precedent. Paine just cuts through that. He says, basically, show it to me. If you can't produce it in a visible form, then you don't actually have one.
That must have been incredibly radical. Demanding transparency, a clear rule book.
It really was. Power couldn't just hide in the mists of history, interpreted only by the elite. It had to be tangible, accessible.
And of course, he completely savages the whole idea of hereditary rule. Kings, queens, aristocrats.
Oh, that's maybe the most blistering, even funny part of the book. He treats hereditary succession as just fundamentally absurd. Like, why would an entire nation base its leadership on a biological lottery?
Yeah.
He says it's a system that's just as likely to produce an idiot as a wise ruler, statistically speaking. It's irrational. And worse, it's incredibly expensive, propping up this useless elite class. And he links that cost directly to the taxes crushing the poor.
Which brings us to the part that feels incredibly modern, almost shockingly so, for the 1790s. His detailed social safety net proposal. How on earth did he think this could be funded?
Through a steeply progressive income tax. Specifically targeting large landed estates, he saw that the existing tax system was incredibly unfair, burdening the poor, while the wealthy landowners paid relatively little.
So, tax the rich landowners to fund social programs.
Pretty much. Use that revenue to create a safety net that supports people throughout their lives.
Let's get into the specifics, because they are genuinely stunning for the time.
Right.
What was actually in this welfare package he proposed?
It was remarkably comprehensive. He called for public funding to educate poor children that alone was revolutionary. He proposed maternity grants for women when they had a child.
Wow.
Funds to cover funeral expenses for people who died poor. universal state pensions for everyone over 50 with a higher rate for those over 60, and even public works programs to create jobs for the unemployed.
And importantly, these weren't framed as charity, right? No. This was something the government owed its citizens.
Exactly. He completely flipped the narrative. Poverty, he argued, wasn't usually the individual's fault. It was a direct consequence of bad governments that wasted vast sums on wars, on royal families, on corruption, instead of investing in their people.
So a legitimate government's job includes ensuring the economic well-being of its people.
That was his radical claim. It's a core responsibility.
Okay, let's try and pull out the main themes here, the big takeaways that still resonate so strongly today. The first one has to be that idea about the current generation being in charge.
Absolutely. The sovereignty of the living. That's huge. No tradition, no ancient law, no dead king's decree can override the rights and needs of the people alive right now. It basically empowers every generation to question the systems they inherit. Are they still working for us?
It's a constant call for relevance. Second, his attack on power based purely on birthright, the tyranny and absurdity of hereditary government.
Right. And while we don't have many kings ruling today, that critique is still vital. It pushes us to scrutinize any system where power or massive advantage is inherited rather than earned. Think about, you know, dynastic wealth, entrenched corporate power, maybe even political families. Is it rational? Is it fair?
Third, that groundbreaking link he made between how a country is governed and the existence of poverty. Social justice as a systemic goal.
Yes. He argued poverty is largely manufactured by bad governance, by wasteful spending, unfair taxes. So, he argued, a legitimate government has a positive duty to reduce poverty and promote general welfare. You can draw a straight line from that idea to modern social security, universal basic income debates, things like that.
It's the philosophical underpinning. And finally, his insistence on reason as the ultimate guide.
Yeah, above all else. Political decisions, the structure of government itself, it all needs to be based on rational principles, on logic, on evidence, not on superstition or blind tradition or emotional appeals. It's a call for clear thinking in politics.
Paine was also just incredibly quotable. His passion really comes through in these sharp, memorable lines.
He definitely had a way with words. Very direct.
Let's share maybe three key ones that really capture his spirit.
Okay. First, that rejection of being bound by the past. The vanity and presumption of governing beyond the grave is the most ridiculous and insolent of all tyrannies.
You can really feel the anger there.
Okay.
Second, defining the state itself, that society versus government idea.
Right. Society is produced by our wants and government by our wickedness. The former promotes our happiness positively, the latter negatively by restraining our vices. It's such a concise way to frame government as a tool, hopefully limited, serving society's needs.
And the third, maybe his demand for that tangible rulebook for power.
Yes, the constitutional point. A constitution is not a thing in name only, but in fact. It has not an ideal, but a real existence. And wherever it cannot be produced in a visible form, there is none. Bam. No hiding behind vague traditions. Put it in writing.
So these are powerful ideas from over 200 years ago.
Yeah.
How do they apply now? What's the real life application for us today?
Well, first, I think, is civic engagement. Paine basically tells us citizenship isn't passive. It's an active contract. We, the living, are sovereign. So his work gives us the philosophical backing to hold our elected officials accountable, to demand transparency, to participate.
It also gives us a lens for constitutional debates, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Anytime there's a discussion about government power or individual rights, we can apply Paine's test. Is this rule clear? Is it written down? Is it accessible? Does it genuinely limit power or does it obscure it? His critique of the unwritten British system is a great benchmark.
And maybe applying his critique of aristocracy to modern inequality.
Definitely. Scrutinizing inequality and its sources. Paine railed against hereditary privilege. We need to ask today, what systems perpetuate unearned advantage? Is it inherited wealth concentration? Is it unequal access to education or political influence? Are our economic policies promoting general welfare? Or are they, in Paine's terms, supporting a modern kind of parasitic elite? His work forces that uncomfortable question.
You know, what really stands out to me reflecting on this is how integrated his vision was.
Mm-hmm.
I think I initially pigeonholed him as just the common sense guy focused purely on political independence. But seeing the rights of man, especially part two, with the detailed economic plans, the pensions, the education funds, the maternity grants, it shows he understood deeply that political liberty doesn't mean much if you don't have basic economic security. You need both.
That really is the profound and maybe the most enduring insight, isn't it? Paine demonstrated that political systems aren't sacred mysteries handed down from on high. They are human inventions. They're tools.
Tools we build.
Exactly. Tools that society creates and controls, hopefully through reason, to protect our rights and maximize well-being. His ultimate message, I think, is that we, the living, have not just the right, but maybe even the duty to redesign those tools when they stop working for us. It's a fundamentally empowering and, frankly, ongoing revolutionary idea.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.